What is not understood is often is often feared. And today I want to talk about four actors who are increasingly cast in sinister roles. Indeed, they are probably today fueling the imagination of the writers of the next Bond movies. These are the new power brokers, a set of forces and people in the world who are playing an increasingly influential role, but one that has, to date, lacked transparency about motives, about outcomes, and perhaps about what their long-term place in the in our global political economy is. This is a topic that has engaged me substantially because I spend about half of my time in Asia serving a range of organisations, but including some of these players who are now becoming the subject of such interest. And The Economist, when it has military helicopters and associates them with sovereign wealth funds, in, I think, a delightfully cheeky way, nevertheless plays on worries and fears people have about these new power brokers. So today I want to talk about answer four questions. Who are they? Are they here to stay, or are they a passing phenomena? What are the new dynamics that they're introducing into the global capital markets and indeed into the global political economy? And what are the risks associated with them, and is there anything much we can really do about that? So who are these players, and how big are they really? Well, the four players that I'll be discussing today are those who control the petrodollar assets of the world, which is the oil exporters of the Middle East, Norway, Russia, Venezuela, Indonesia, and Nigeria. And as you can see in this picture, as we start to get some sense of their scale, they have accumulated assets of nearly $4 trillion. $2.3 trillion of those belong to the Middle East, and the rest are spread around the smaller players. Asian central banks, who, of course, put some of their money into various sovereign wealth funds as well. Hedge funds, which are those intriguing pools of private capital that are not subject to the same disclosure rules as traditional funds, and who deploy a very diverse range of strategies and are often marked by the way in which they use leverage in those strategies. And finally, private equity, the smallest of all of these players. Now, if we start to have a look at these players, they are truly new on the horizon. Since 2000, their assets have more than tripled. They also now together represent 40% of the size of the pension and insurance funds, and they hold and control 5% of the world's total financial assets. To give a sense of their scale, let's kind of plot them in relation to some of the other entities we may be familiar with. If you look plot them against global asset managers, you'll find that at least collectively they exceed the size of the world's largest managers of capital, and individually, and this is, I suspect, where it is kind of more interesting, the individual holders of some of these funds rank alongside the Barclays and the State Streets of the world. These are very sizable players who have become sizable remarkably quickly. It becomes interesting to understand what these players and actors are really up to, whether or not some of these sinister images are worthwhile when we get down into who really has all of these controls, all of these assets. Let us be clear, though, when we talk about these players, that the actual corporate size of a number of these entities is massive. We forget these private entities rank ahead of the publicly listed entities of the world in size of scale of their corporate dimensions. So these are very substantial individual players who have gained scale, as I say, very, very fast. If you look at the Kuwait Petroleum Corporation ranks ahead of GE. I mean, these are large players, and the tail, if we put companies like Petronas and others off the end, there will be a big bunch of these smaller petrodollar funds that lie right up at the top end here. The interesting question, as I say, becomes who controls these funds? Where are they really? Who really manages them? Where do they end up going? Well, if we start with the petrodollars, and remember, well over half of these are controlled out of the Middle East. This is not an easy thing to get to the bottom of, mind you, because it's taken us quite some effort to do it. But you'll find that these oil revenues, and which really are effectively, you know, a kind of a global tax, energy tax on the world that is flowing to one quite particular set of players, only 60% of them end up in state entities. 40% of these dollars are in the hands of a relatively small number of private individuals, some of whom you see listed there. But it's important to recognise that they do end up in a sophisticated set of vehicles, whether they are sovereign wealth funds, and you know, I will make some mention today of the Abu Dhabi Investment Authority, which is a particularly interesting sovereign wealth fund. But also, and it's important to recognise that Norway's Oil Stabilisation Fund has been charting this territory for a little time and gives us a model of a more mature sovereign wealth fund that perhaps gives some direction to what we might hope for or increasingly require of some of the others. Of course, we have, you know, investment corporations. They end up in the central banks and, as I say, in the hands of private individuals. And some of the money is, and this has been where it's probably been most controversially and publicly noted, it goes into direct investment in foreign corporations. In terms of the Asian dollars, there really are just two major players here, which, of course, are China and Japan. And there you get a picture of the very, very rapid growth in the funds that they have held. Now, originally, that journey began in a lot of ways as a journey to ensure that they had protection against another Asian crisis. And I'll say a little more in a moment about how far we've gone beyond them being in that position. But they are the players who really are, and if you look at the assets they're holding, these really are the most conservative of the players that we'll talk about, and they largely hold government paper in the United States, or Europe. Though increasingly, some of these other Asian players are flowing their funds into Asian sovereign wealth funds. Now, if we think about this set of players, while we're talking about the scale, hedge funds, also, again, we see that it is a relatively small number of players who control the largest portion of the assets in this asset class. But these are actually, when you look at them, a number of them are actually quite transparent, well-known organisations. And, you know, perhaps that's worth noting when we compare them to the others. What we should also observe is that this set of phenomena are well linked. And if you think about the links of it, the petrodollars and Asian banks have actually helped to create the low-cost liquidity that has driven private equity and hedge funds. These are an interestingly linked set of phenomena rather than purely disconnected. And increasingly, we've seen that the petrodollars initially, and increasingly some of the Asian funds, are actually driving demand for hedge fund type assets. So these have become major consumers of these new classes of assets. Various of the hedge fund managers we interviewed around the world reported that currently up between 25% and in some cases 50% of their funding was coming out of petrodollars. So these new sources of funding are driving some of these more innovative elements of the financial system. And what do we say about these set of players? I think a few things we need to be clear about. First is that power is concentrated. This is a remarkable concentration of financial power, not just in the hands of a limited number of entities, but increasingly actually in the hands of a limited number of players or corporations. There is a low level of transparency. What distinguishes all of these asset classes is that they are not subject to the kinds of public reporting, on the whole, a few cases aside, that we are used to. So understanding the motives of these actors and what their long-term intentions are is not straightforward. And increasingly, and I'll talk about that more in a moment, they do have different agendas to the traditional players in these spaces. Question is, are these players here to stay? And if so, for how long? Which is the second question I really want to tackle. Let us begin with the petrodollars. Petrodollars, you know, that's a phenomenon that's resulted from the tripling of oil prices, which, you know, was floating at $99 a barrel, this morning. This has been a huge increase. Now, that our analysis of what is likely to happen in this space is that even were oil prices to drop way back down to $30 a barrel, which is the bottom of that chart, we would still see very, very substantial increases in petrodollar assets right out for the next 5 years. Our own analysis suggests that $50 a barrel is a more plausible long-term price for oil, and that would see, while the rate of accumulation dropping off a bit, it is still going to remain very substantial. That's the middle case. Petrodollars are a phenomena that are very clearly here to stay, at least out into the medium term, and they are going to grow. They are going to grow more substantial. These will become even bigger gorillas in the financial markets. Now, what about Asia? Now, as I mentioned before, the Asian game began as a game to protect themselves from. Give them coverage against another Asian crisis. Now, the general rule of thumb for maintaining that kind of protection is that you should have enough to cover 3 to 4 months' worth of foreign reserves, enough to cover 3 to 4 months of imports. Well, that would mean they would only need to hold $0.7 trillion in reserves. They actually hold $2.6 trillion. So they are well above what's necessary for ensuring some national security. Where they really have moved to is, as I think is well understood and known, this they are using their exchange rates as a key part of their economic strategy. Now, one of the things that they are ensuring that their export-driven economies remain competitive, and the only way they can do that is by holding ever larger sums of denominated assets in the countries in which they are seeking to export to keep the exchange rates, particularly with the United States and Europe, in the kind of range that they have been in. Now, we will also see in these that this is actually a very, very difficult imbalance to correct. In some ways, with a geopolitical hat on, you'd say we have the financial equivalent now of mutually assured destruction existing between Asia and the United States. If Asia were to dramatically pull their assets out of the United States, the value of those assets would plummet, something they clearly are not keen to do. And on the other side of the equation, if they were in any way forced out, American inflation driven by increased the devaluation of their dollar and rapidly increased import prices would similarly be fairly catastrophic for the US economy, and of course the same applies in Europe. So this is a position that takes some time to unwind and a lot of care to do it. On our analysis, nevertheless, we would expect there is to be some correction. But even if the yuan was revalued by 15%, which is perhaps a modest estimate, you'll still see, and here's the accumulation chart, and if Japan, which is probably its challenge is a little bit understated at the moment, I think, if it was to stay essentially stable, you are still going to see massive growth in these assets held in Asia over the next 5 years. As to the hedge funds, I mean, these funds, and I think it's really important we note this, to understand what their future is likely to be, while having been driven really by the doubling of high net worth individuals in a very short period of time, have moved from being a kind of exotic instrument into an increasingly institutionalised instrument. These are no longer exotic. Once, you know, where individuals accounted just 10 years back for 60% of the investment into these asset classes, that's now down to 40%. These are becoming a permanent feature of the landscape, an important part of portfolio diversification. They are also the financial the sort of foundations of financial innovation that drew them, that enabled them to be possible, will only actually increase. We may see, of course, a little step back during our current circumstances as people reevaluate what strategies really work. But these are likely to. There's every reason to think this will remain a pretty substantial feature of the global picture. And if when we looked at it and modelled a range of different scenarios, even on a pretty substantial correction in this area, which may flow out, it is still going to remain a very significant force in the financial markets. We do, however, have a slightly different view of private equity, which is probably the rising cost of capital is going to shake out the private equity market. And so here you see our three kind of scenarios of that with some reasonable degree of correction. And the reason we think there's likely to be a reasonable degree of correction is the very varied performance of private equity funds. Again, not an easy thing to establish, but clearly top quartile performers are doing a great job and are likely to stick around and are clearly deploying performance improvement strategies, not just taking advantage of the low cost of capital in the way they're going about their interventions. But you'll see that really there's 50% of these funds are returning below market, and you can expect some quite serious shakeout over the next couple of years in that whole space. So private equity, while remaining a force, is maybe becoming a less dramatic force. And as I say, it was the smallest anyway, even if perhaps the most talked about. So what are the new dynamics these players are introducing? Four, I think, that are really important. The first is they are creating longer-term investment horizons and a move towards higher risk return profiles. So these players are actually changing the investment preferences and priorities amongst all of the areas that they're investing in. And that's actually quite important for the way we see future investment strategies playing out. And what is enabling that is if you look at the character of these funds and of these different classes of investment. If we start with the Asian central banks and the petrodollars, they are not financial intermediaries, and therefore they lack liabilities. So therefore they are not subject to nearly the same set of constraints as traditional players. They're unlike mutual funds, is that they don't have shareholders who can withdraw capital if they get nervous. So these are players who are structurally able to invest for the long and very long term, as some of them are quite clearly doing. And hedge funds have, if we step back in terms of a chart between more and less liabilities, which sort of affects your investment horizon, even hedge funds tend to have fewer individual investors, and they are able to set all sorts of constraints around the ability to pull capital out, which again enables them to play to the longer term. And private equity funds, of course, also can lock up their capital for periods of time, again enabling a longer term horizon to be taken. They also, all of these funds have the potential to take on much higher levels of risk. And increasingly we're seeing them do that. Clearly the hedge funds have done that, adopting much higher, both in their strategies and in the levels of leverage that they've taken on. Petrodollars, interestingly, are starting to migrate into that direction. It is a pretty diverse group, so the migration is somewhat varied. Compare a couple of the players in this space, Saudi Arabia, who actually is the more conservative investor. They've got 20% of their assets in cash and deposits, and 55% in fixed income on our calculations. Compare that with the Abu Dhabi Investment Authority, which is probably one of the kind of the bellwethers in this space. They've got 10% in cash and only 10 to 15% in fixed income, the rest in more adventurous asset classes. And if you want a benchmark for that, a US retail investor would have about 16% in cash and deposits and 39% in fixed income. So these players are already moving down the risk-return profile more aggressively than your standard investor is. The Asian central banks remain conservative, except insofar as they're putting their money into their sovereign wealth funds. And clearly some of them are starting to break out and do more exciting things with their funds, such as China's $3 billion in the Blackstone Group. This is clearly a sign of things to come. And they're increasingly moving, and China's increasingly moving its funds into its state investment vehicles to move out of their currently pretty very conservative position in US Treasuries primarily and some European paper. Now, what's going on in Asia is we should see that trend continuing, because actually there's an enormous opportunity cost in holding these very conservative instruments that is, in fact, has some quite significant impact on Asian GDP. There is an opportunity cost to holding your funds in effectively low-yielding US Treasuries or European government instruments. And when we calculate it, we think across Asia, if they could have invested that more profitably, either in the growth of their own economy or in higher returning asset classes, it may be holding back GDP by almost 1% across Asia. There is a massive opportunity cost for Asia, which is pushing a whole range of their governments to start to move this stuff into higher return asset classes. And that is a pressure that will remain, so we should expect to see these funds grow in size as they move out of some of their more conservative positions over time. A couple of other phenomena that we should be clear about. The next one is the growth, the lowering the cost of capital. There have been some very nice analysis in paper by Warnock and Warnock to the Federal Reserve, which did a very elegant correlation of what was happening between investments into US Treasuries and long-term US interest rates. And we used those to then say, what's that doing if you started to look at all of the other classes of assets? And so around the world, we think that this flush of capital is probably responsible for at least 130 basis points off the cost of capital around the world, which is a very significant constant downward pressure, which from the picture I've shown will only remain or increase on capital around the world. Once we negotiate the current environment, that we would expect to see that pressure again, picking up. The other thing that's been critically important is hedge funds have increased liquidity in global markets very, very substantially, playing an important role there. And this shows the percent of hedge funds, an estimate of their percent of trading in various classes. So they're accounting for anywhere between 30 and 50% of the trade in any asset class. So they're introducing a great deal of liquidity into the major global capital markets. And that, I think, is a substantial assistance in the evolution and efficiency of these markets. And when you see that role, you can also start to see why, in our current environment, liquidity could dry up so fast when they are forced to exit the markets, given the enormous role that they've played. The other phenomena that we should talk about is that these investors are stimulating the development of the emerging world very substantially. They disproportionately invest in Asia and emerging economies. If you look at where the Gulf Cooperation Council is putting all of its funds, you're seeing it put substantially more into, and it's partly to do with their own political connections and alliances. You're seeing them put substantially more into the emerging markets than would be common from any of the other US or European investors, who would typically put about 5% of their assets into the emerging markets rather than the kind of numbers that you're seeing there, which they're putting up to 22% into those markets. And commonly we're seeing at least 15 by these players into the emerging world. Also, although it's very, very early days, not least given the origins of some of this of these funds, Islamic finance is going to continue to get a big fillip from these investors, as they, you know, not least, you know, because of their Islamic Islamic origins, a lot of these funds are looking for vehicles to be able to put this in that is consistent with those underlying beliefs. And if you take any view about growing conservatism in any of those countries, you would expect this phenomenon to expand even more dramatically. Finally, the final thing that is that we would see as really important is that even with private equity's role diminishing, they clearly are creating a new kind of market, a new kind of private capital market. And just to give you a flavour of it, what we've plotted here is IPOs to private transactions, which gives you a sense of the depth of this, increasing depth of this market. And what we're seeing, you know, and we've seen in the last handful of years, is that private transactions have exceeded IPOs in the United States and Europe. So that actually says there's a huge, this is a real shift. There really is the emergence of a much more substantial private to private market. And that, in our mind, may step back a little, but it's going to remain, again, a feature of the landscape. If these are the new dynamics of longer term, somewhat higher risk, lower cost of capital, actually not a bad kind of environment in a lot of ways, what are the risks that they're introducing? This is really where are these actors to be feared becomes the real question. There has been, and we've probed it pretty hard, a view that they may have been driving asset price inflation because they've introduced lower cost of capital, or they've been chasing a limited pool of assets. We can find very little evidence that they have been responsible for asset bubbles in equity markets. They have no doubt contributed to an increased, for private equity, clearly over the past years, the cost of transactions has increased, but these players alone can only account for a portion of that increase, and whether they've actually overvalued the assets they're purchasing, I think the jury remains out on. There is some view that they have fueled, in illiquid asset classes, they have fueled some real asset price inflation. There is a view that some of the property market inflation has been as a response to a consequence of both the lowering the cost of the capital but some of their property plays. I mean, Temasek is the largest single property owner, which is the Singaporean sovereign wealth fund, largest single property owner in Sydney. But again, I think that is to overplay their role. But it can't be totally discounted. The other risks that I think one needs to take seriously at present is this, and the jury is genuinely out and on it, is the systemic risks from the hedge funds. They are, as you've seen, from enormous size, and the size I've given you is their size without leverage. So top leverage on top of that, these things are huge. They are highly leveraged, which makes them vulnerable, and they do have a range of illiquid investments, which makes them hard to unwind those positions. So they are vulnerable. And they have, as a result, potential to cause contagion across multiple asset classes. We have a sort of moderating view of that question when you look at what the strategies are that these funds have deployed. People look back to, you know, long-term capital management's troubles and say, could that really strike us again? Perhaps. But as I say, they have become substantially more diverse. And here you see they've moved, you know, from having investment strategies based on bets on directional movements being a very big part of the strategies of these funds, down to a much smaller part. Arbitrage, which is, you know, much less risky kind of way of going about it, has become a quarter of these scale of their investment strategies. So I think one needs to moderate kind of fears about what could happen in that space. But we just don't know yet. But there is the maturity and of this kind of this market, I think, gives us reason at least to be perhaps to be not overly worried about what could play out play out in that whole space. There clearly is some credit risk also that's emerging for major banks from private equity and hedge funds that actually do have to liquidate their positions. The work we've done has tended to say, when we've looked at any of the major banks' positions, that they are reasonably well protected. It's going to hurt. Will it cause any of them to go under? It appears that's relatively unlikely. And would it cause contagion right across the whole system? Again, the positions that we've seen the banks deploy against these asset classes at least suggest it'll be a kind of a rocky road, but not ultimately imperiling. The final question, I suppose, is the one that, you know, captures Australian attention from time to time, is what about the non-economic motives of these actors? Is this something to be concerned about? And I think here history at least is going to suggest pretty strongly to us that to date, the sovereign wealth funds who've been taking positions in private corporations in the developed world have been very prudent and very cautious about how they've gone about these exercises. They also, some of them have been burnt. Temasek got burnt in Indonesia when it bought its second mobile phone operation there. They are experienced. They've been through the Dubai ports exercise. They know the scrutiny that they will get subjected to. So we need to be cautious about kind of fear and panic in this space. The only thing to be said about it is all of the preceding analysis I've kind of presented does suggest they're going to need to move out into asset classes that will raise more questions if they want to get out of such strong positions in conservative assets. They are going to get further into direct investments in developed world corporations and into various, you know, we've seen what China's done with Blackstone. Admittedly, there, important to note, they took non-voting stock, which again I think will be part of their strategy for dealing with it. So we will see them being more present, and it will always be a challenge. And China, you know, is clearly subject to very intense scrutiny around what they're doing in investments in resource producers. And I think any sensible national interest will always be keeping a very close eye on what's going on, as Australia, I think, is doing well. What should we be doing about these players? Well, I think the first thing is moving out of seeing them as kind of the next villains in Bond movies. That's the more they are subjected to that kind of demonisation, the less we watch closely what their real motives are. I think we do, however, need to be encouraging some significant developments in this space. I think we do need to be pushing hard for the disclosure of investment strategies, government governance approaches, and their risk management approaches. If one of these things goes belly up, it would have very bad consequences, clearly. They are very opaque. And as I say, Norway does at least give us a model to a standard which we could start to increasingly require some of these other entities to live up to. I think that's critical if these players are to become better understood, if the potential upside of their role in the world economy is to be better captured, we need to start to require far greater disclosure. I think regulators also need to be ready to differentiate here and understand that there are quite different types of actors involved, and be ready to ask appropriately different sets of questions, given the quite different investment approaches being brought by these entities. So I think there is a role for regulatory evolution in this whole space, and certainly into the hedge fund space, every reason to be saying that some more traditional requirements should be brought to bear on funds that are now becoming much more institutionalised. When it was truly belonged to private individuals, it was one thing. When it's 60% of these are effectively in vehicles not dissimilar to those that other, you know, well-regulated fund environments are. There's a lot to suggest these things should be subject to that same kind of standard regulation. I think also the recent environments highlight something that was apparent in our own analysis well before things headed the direction they did, is there's a big need for an upgraded risk management around this whole space. This is clearly still, and partly because of the lack of transparency, the nature of the risks in this space are still relatively poorly understood. And there is a need for far better technical analysis of what is going on, and for some greater conservatism around the way the risks that some of these players are introducing get managed. But overall, I think the messages that one should kind of take away is that these players are a pretty positive force in the global economy. They are putting downward pressure on interest rates, which, so long as it doesn't drive asset price inflation, as should be seen as a healthy thing, particularly in the developing world, where access to capital is vital. They are increasing liquidity, and promoting the development of in the emerging world markets, which is, you know, a vital part of ensuring these markets grow in scale and integration into the global economy. That's important. They are moving out of the much criticised short-term investment strategies, which I think many corporations can celebrate, as they potentially have investors who are there for the much longer term, in terms of ensuring we have corporations that are healthy as well as performing. They represent a stabilising force in the global political economy, as they really lock Asia, Europe. And the United States into modest steps in the evolution of their relationships. And in all probability, they are actually not introducing unacceptable levels of risk into the global economy. So I think it is time to take this set of actors off the list of Bond movie villains and to start to see them as a permanent feature of the landscape that we should increasingly move to fully institutionalise and subject to the same kind of standards that other economic actors around the world have been subjected to. Thank you.